Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Bitcoin is a relatively new asset class, and the market for Bitcoin is subject to rapid changes and uncertainty. Bitcoin is largely unregulated, and Bitcoin investments may be more susceptible to fraud and manipulation than more regulated investments. Bitcoin is subject to unique and substantial risks, including significant price volatility, lack of liquidity, and theft. Bitcoin is subject to rapid price swings, including as a result of actions and statements by influencers and the media, changes in the supply and demand of Bitcoin, and other factors. There is no assurance that Bitcoin will maintain its value over the long term. ARK strongly encourages any investor considering an investment in Bitcoin or any other digital asset to consult with a financial professional before investing. All statements made regarding Bitcoin are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or podcast guests and are not recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold Bitcoin. Historical results are not indications of future results.
Welcome to the Bitcoin Brainstorm. I'm your host, Rod Rudy, co-founder of Bitcoin Park, a community-supported campus right here in Nashville, Tennessee, focused on grassroots freedom tech adoption and a home for Bitcoiners to work, learn, collaborate, and build. We are now on episode number 12. Thanks again to the support from Kathy, Yassine, and the entire ARK team. We are taking our monthly Bitcoin topic-based approach at Bitcoin Park and applying it to this monthly podcast series we are calling Bitcoin Brainstorm. Each month, we have a different topic and invite amazing people from a variety of areas within the Bitcoin community. Our aim is simple: drive conversation around Bitcoin. And we are now here today continuing a very important topic, one that is near and dear to us all: funding and supporting Bitcoin and open source development. So we have approximately 60 minutes and we'll be covering a lot. Let's do some quick introductions and then just jump right into it. Let me start first with the managing partner of 1031 and co-founder of OpenSats, and also my dear co-founder of Bitcoin Park, Matt O'Dell.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Welcome, my friend. Next, let's go to Jack Dorsey, founder of Twitter and Block, and also leading by example with substantial support to the FOSS ecosystem.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is co-founder and executive director of Brink, Mike Schmidt.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And if you guys haven't heard episode number 5, you should check that out. Mike was on with Kathy and I and Yassine back then as well. Also, Alex Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And always, Kathy Wood, founder, CEO, and CIO at ARK Invest. Welcome, Kathy.
Happy to be here. 12th episode, 1 year, very special, special one.
And again, thank you. And I was saying this to Jack, Matt, Mike, and Alex, and Kathy while we were getting set up. Thank you again to the entire ARK team. You guys carving out a specific playlist just for the Bitcoin Brainstorm for us to riff on just Bitcoin means a lot to us. So thanks again. Since I have Matt finally on the show, I want to just ask him first and foremost and kick it over to him. Why is this conversation we're having today so important?
Open source software. I like to call open source software freedom tech. I like to call it the freedom tech movement. And why is that? It's because at the core, it's all about freedom. The beauty of open source software, open source protocols, open source hardware is at its core, it's not controlled or owned by a single individual, company, entity, government. It can outlive its creator. An open source project might be launched by a single individual, might be launched by a group of people. Those people can disappear. Other people can pick up where it left off. It can outlive us all. So open source is absolutely fundamental to the global freedom movement in a digital age? Because if you do have someone that controls a piece of software or a tool, they can be pressured, they can be corrupted. The core ethos of that tool can be compromised. So it's absolutely instrumental that we support open source contributors, that we support the open source movement, and that we keep pushing it forward.
And I guess maybe going one back, and then I'd love other people to jump in. Like, how do you guys explain open source to people? And I'll maybe tell a quick story. You know, I was in big tech for so long, and a lot of the audience listening to this podcast are maybe more on the financial services side. So this may be their first time even hearing about free and open source software and why this is important. But I'm curious, like Mike, especially with your work at Brink, like how do you explain what is free and open source software?
It's interesting. We touched on it in episode 5, as you mentioned. And I think the thing that I like to emphasize is that it is a way to garner trust in a project, the fact that you can verify the code, or that other people can verify the code, or that you can hire somebody to verify the code, that the thing that you're running is the thing that you're intending to run. And it's interesting, since that episode, there's been at least 3 incidents that maybe we can dig into a bit that sort of take that theoretical explanation and put it a little bit more applicable. Even just this morning, this outage with this CrowdStrike platform is one of them. And there's a couple of things there that maybe we could touch on briefly, and then I can pass it along. But obviously, this is a closed source platform that also does automatic updates, right? And so there's potentially millions or more different computers that were pushed this faulty, it appears to be a bug, not a hack per se, update. And that automatic update went in, and there's nothing that anybody could do about that now. It broke. Airlines are shut down. Airports are shut down. Nobody knew what code that was.
Hospitals.
Nobody knows what that code was. In theory, it could have been worse, I suppose. So nobody knows what that code was, and it was automatically pushed. Where in the Bitcoin ecosystem, we are against automatic updates for something like Bitcoin Core, because you could just push out a malicious update to all the users. So it's opt-in, and you can also verify that code. So that's one example that comes to mind that is a tangible explanation of why open source can be valuable.
You know, one thing as I'm just thinking about this, you know, the Bitcoin price today is up quite a bit. And I'm wondering, you know, we have, Yassine wrote a paper on the risk off nature of Bitcoin. And here's another example. The first one was around the regional bank crisis a year ago, and you know, really highlighting no counterparty risk in the Bitcoin ecosystem. This is another hedge against a risk, you know, highlighting this very important attribute that you just described, Mike. Yassine wrote a paper about the risk-off nature of Bitcoin. Most people before the regional bank crisis in March of 23 thought of Bitcoin as just risk-on, a risky asset, extremely volatile. And then during the regional bank crisis, more and more people learned that, hey, Bitcoin has an attribute here that the banking system doesn't have. There's no counterparty risk. Here today, with CrowdStrike going down and taking out wide swaths of the global economy, you know, the open source nature of Bitcoin and no automated updates and just a huge neighborhood watch ecosystem, everybody watching their livelihoods, you know, and watching the ecosystem for the good of humanity, Matt, as you say, freedom. So very, very interesting. Each one of these crises is highlighting the benefits of, you know, Bitcoin.
I would go even further, right? So Bitcoin, the protocol, is, you know, incredibly robust. It is designed in a way to be incredibly robust and to almost never go down. But one interesting aspect is the Bitcoiners that are building on top of the protocol share a lot of that ethos and a lot of those values. So you mentioned specifically the Bitcoin price moving. Now, the Bitcoin price relies on many different exchanges that are facilitating transactions. With the CrowdStrike failure, we saw a lot of banks go down. But, you know, Jack's company, Cash App, one of our portfolio companies at 1031 Strike, they were completely operating during all of this as it was happening because Bitcoiners understand a lot of these risks and they build their companies in a way to try and make them as robust as possible, not quite as robust as the Bitcoin protocol, but as robust as possible to stand up in times of chaos.
That's very well said. Gladstein, anything you would like to add, especially from a global perspective?
Yeah, just from a human rights perspective, it's interesting to look at the architecture of, let's say, closed source versus open source. You know, on the one hand, you have this sort of black box, proprietary, auto update, hard fork design, which sounds very totalitarian and essentially sort of steers people into centralized control mechanisms. So even if something starts out benign, if it's closed source, you know, it can be very corrupted. And that's something that I think human rights activists naturally start to understand, that they want something that's open, that's citizen powered, that's verifiable, accountable. And that steers you more towards individual sovereignty. And it's ultimately, it's more in line with a, you know, systems of control and power that are that are controlled by the people as opposed to controlled by one person or a small group of people. And something I really liked in, to move away from, well, rather to focus on how software inspires human interaction. In Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, her whole thesis is that basically monetary systems up until essentially 2008/2009 were evolving scientifically in a way that was centralizing. So like it was never going to happen any other way. Basically, you had the invention of scientific advancements like the telegraph and computerization and things like that that were driving humans towards faster and more efficient transactions, but at the expense of centralization. And she talks a lot about how this is really evident when you look at the banking structures. There used to be so many different banks, and then eventually they just sort of congealed into this like global central banking system. And that wasn't avoidable. Like there was no conspiracy. It's actually just how scientific evolution happened with money. And then all of a sudden we get this new chance with Bitcoin. And it's what's really cool about it is we are rapidly evolving and advancing and engineering and improving. And we're on a different track. We're actually going towards more individual sovereignty and more sort of control in the hands of the individuals. And I'm sure Jack will mention this, but you're seeing something similar with Nostr as well, where it's like, you know, you had the whole design of the internet, which was around advertising and control. And now we have a new option to move towards a communication system, essentially, that puts more power into the hands of the people. So even though open source, closed source code sounds very technical, it's actually got a very deep human meaning that's very, very relevant to human rights activists.
Jack, anything you want to expand on that as it relates to like these open protocols and built benefits of building on top of open networks?
Yeah, I mean, just back to the question on why open source. I don't know of a faster way to spread an idea than open source. It, in its very nature, the fact that anyone can read the code, anyone can build on top of the code, anyone can own the code and completely change it, build their own system. And we've proven this over and over and over again. The internet exists because of open source. Every single device you encounter and interact with every day is built on open source. You have open source in your pocket. This call is made possible by open source. Now, all the companies utilizing it might not appreciate that, might not advertise that, definitely benefit from it massively, may not give back enough from everything that they've taken to make their product useful to people. But everything we do in this world today is at the at the result of some programmer wanting to learn something, being gracious enough to give it away for free in order to learn more and to learn faster and to spread an idea. And I just don't, there's no other development model that I've seen that allows such a velocity as open source. The second thing is we're talking a lot about permissionless technologies. Matt calls them freedom technologies. I'm going to focus on permission. A lot of the interactions we have in this world, we require permission from the government, from a corporation, from ourselves, maybe, in order to speak in the way that we want or act in the way that we want. But if we're going to build permissionless technologies, we need a permissionless development model. And open source is the only way to do that. You don't need anyone's permission to take the code, to change the code, to add code to it, to remove code, to build a completely separate project and distribute it to people. And I think that parallel is really important. Like, you just can't build permissionless technologies, no matter how hard you try to prove them or advertise them as such, without having permissionless development models. And then the third that I also think is critical and has been mentioned is the ownership aspect. The fact that this is not just open software, not just transparent that you can read the code, but it's normally free as well. And in many cases, that's without license, with very creative licensees to create derivative works and even build companies around those derivative works. It's not always consistent, but the fact that we have a legal structure around ownership for this free and open software is really important, really critical, and should also be defended. And it's been under attack recently. The recent Craig Wright shenanigans that we just defeated was an attack not on Bitcoin, it was an attack on the open source development model. Like, all of open source development model was at risk if he won those cases. And there will be more attacks. That's not it. There will be more sophisticated adversaries. And, you know, as we continue this discussion, it's not just about funding open source developers, but all the mechanics and the infrastructure around that, including legal defense, including policy and regulatory pushback. For people who are not, who hate this stuff, they don't want to do it with anything legal. They don't want to do it with anything having to do with policy or regulatory. So much so that we've had a number of, and Mike can speak to this, we've had a number of developers leave Bitcoin development entirely for the fear of being sued, or in the worst case, having some other penalty put upon them. So as we think about open source and what it takes to fund it in a way that these developers feel independent, like, I think it's also important to consider all the infrastructure around them and where the gaps are. And that's what concerns me the most moving forward is those gaps. Because because you can't attack the model, because it is so permissionless and free, you're going to attack where the model intersects with society and where it intersects with the law. And that's where we haven't done enough work to really define the defenses that folks need to continue this work. And if we don't figure it out, then again, the open source development model is under attack and something that could not go away technically, but go away because no one wants to work on it because they don't want to take the risk. And that's super scary. And like, we're seeing more and more of those adversaries as we go on year by year.
May I pipe in here just in, you know, the adversaries and how they might change over time. Just for our listener base, what's gone on in the financial markets is unbelievable. This idea that the Mag Six, the Magnificent Six, would represent such concentration. They account for 45% of the average large cap growth managers portfolio. And these ecosystems, for the most part, are closed. And sort of the centralization vector and the power structure. I mean, this is typically a very unhealthy development. unless something is going to change it. And what's very interesting in looking back in history, going back into the Great Depression, as new technologies were evolving, telephone, electricity, and internal combustion engine, the same concentration had taken place because everyone was afraid to invest in almost anything. Was it going to go bankrupt with unemployment up at 25% and GDP down 30%? But what happened was these new technologies created an environment where the mega cap stocks actually started to underperform dramatically because these new technologies were taking over. And I think you've just described why and how we should be thinking that way now as well, and how we should protect it.
Yeah, totally. I don't think we have enough people thinking about it, to be honest. And there's certainly very, very few companies doing it. And I do think they have a moral responsibility, especially if they're working with these technologies. But you have to drag them along currently. And we just need a few more to really inspire that momentum. And I think it will compound. But I'm not just talking about the recent batch. Like, it's the Googles, the Microsofts, the Netflixes of the world, who their entire business is attributable to open source success and open source platforms. And a lot of those companies do give back meaningfully to open source. But at the size and the scale that they are, it could be a much, much higher percentage.
That's very interesting.
So the attack vectors are very interesting. And I actually want to open this up to, because I want to talk this out so that other people can learn. I do think when people are like, oh, how can Bitcoin fail? And I say one word, apathy. If people are apathetic towards working on Bitcoin, using Bitcoin, following the privacy preserving aspects, I mean, Dr. Laffer says this all the time when we chat, I need private money to be able to use the way I want to use it. Those are my words, but I believe that's what he says. And so, Jack, those are really interesting points. I guess my next question for the group is, and I could tee it up to Mike, is like, how do we get more people involved and more people excited then, and more people aware such that, and I have a couple ideas, but I'm curious about this group. Cause I do think there's an interesting time period that we're in right now. And if we miss this opportunity, it would really be terrible. So I'm curious, Mike, what are some ways that we can, get this going even more?
Sure. To piggyback on what Jack was talking about, I can give a couple tangible examples without naming names. With the Craig Wright lawsuit against the Bitcoin Core developers, there was at least one senior developer that I spoke with when that was still going on and in flight before the trial, saying, maybe I'll be back after the trial wraps up, depending on how that goes. So we as a community lost a very seasoned Bitcoin Core developer for a period of time, and could have, if this continued, could have been longer, for years, diminished their contributions to the project due to legal threats. I spoke with another developer recently who's scaling back their involvement as well. And this is in regards to some of the Samurai wallet activity and legal action around their services and software that they provided as well. So now there's just another wave of it. It may be easy to look on from the outside and say, well, Craig Wright is a clown, and that shouldn't affect how people. It's people got stacks of legal letters at their door. Right. And these aren't the kind of people who want the limelight, let alone being in the limelight for legal reasons. So thankfully, due to the efforts of COPA, the Bitcoin Defense Fund, and Jack and folks, we dodged that bullet, but that we don't want to always be fighting the last war. There's going to be something else that comes, and we want to be prepared for that. So that's sort of like stemming existing contributors from leaving or being hesitant to contribute. And then on the getting new contributors side, you know, I think we got a long way to go. I think that there's a narrative on in Bitcoin communities and on social media that something along the lines of Satoshi threw this over the wall in this code is fine. And, you know, even as of the last few weeks, the Bitcoin Core developers released 10 vulnerabilities that they're older vulnerabilities that are in the software. And there's going to be another batch coming in the next few weeks and another batch after that. And that's just not me hypothesizing. They've stated that that's the case. And so I think if people realize that this thing is not done, that there are not just improvements or performance improvements or making sure it runs on the next version of macOS or whatever it is, but there's actually bugs to be found. There's testing to be done and bugs to be fixed. I think that would at least open up the top of funnel for people who are curious and wanting to contribute more.
Just to piggyback off that, I think there's a lot we can do to protect the developers, and Jack obviously is a great example of how you can do that with what he did to help protect us against Craig Wright. There's a new initiative called the P2P Rights Fund, which you can check out. And I would encourage people listening to explore that, which is pledging basically to support developers in the United States if they, you know, feel like they're coming under legal threat for developing open source code. So that's one thing you can look at. At Ahref, we're more focused on expanding development like many of the others here. And again, that's because we think open source code is aligned with values of free speech, open capital markets, property rights. You know, ultimately, this is how we want to build our country, right? People listening, I hope, agree with that. These are the values we want to instill in future generations, not confiscation, censorship, and closed capital markets. That's the way of the dictator, right? So we want to build a truly, I would argue, American future here. And we want to normalize support for open source development, right? That's the key. So right now it's like on the call, you have a lot of the leaders of a small group of people doing this. But hopefully by the end of the decade, we're talking about it being normal for a university to have a Bitcoin research center where they're doing this, where it's normal for every major tech company to do this, and where it's normal for every bank to do this. And there's a playbook, right? So there's a couple things you can do if you're listening and you want to do this. You can of course support existing efforts like OpenSats, Brink, etc. I think that's great. But you can also, you know, build your own foothold inside your company, and you can build your own expertise. You can hire someone to run this for you. All it takes is one person, and you can come message Matt or Mike or any of us. We can give you names of people who would probably really be excited to join your company to run your Bitcoin development stuff. You just need someone who's got a little bit of a feel for the space, and you can start there and you can grow. And you can do different things. I'll just quickly lay out a couple different options that might be interesting to you if you're listening. One of the most important things that's becoming more clear in the space is something called long-term support, which is you take an open source developer and you give them the support they need for a couple of years. And so they don't have to think about raising money or getting another grant. They can just focus on changing the world. That's really important. Very, very exciting stuff. And, you know, that can be done quietly, or it could be done in the style of, for example, if you've ever heard of the MacArthur Foundation, they have geniuses, these genius grants. And it's great for MacArthur, and it's great for the geniuses because they become really well known. TED also has the TED Fellows. So you could brand them as your company or your university. And it's like someone who's basically a fellow. So that's one route you could go. You can also just give grants between, you know, basically these are grants are usually in the 5-digit range, and you can have someone review. You can have incoming applications. You can do a lot of different things with grants. You can do bounties. Bounties are interesting. We've messed around with them a little bit. Obviously, it really speaks to the open source nature of the coding environment to do bounties. Really fun, a little challenging, especially like when someone claims your bounty and you're like trying to do identifying paperwork. It can be interesting. But I would recommend experimenting with bounties. It's quite cool. I think as far as a profit company doing it, I'll give a shout out to Paul. Stackwork. They do a really cool job with this. And bounties are great because they can help your company. I mean, you can like put out some bounties for stuff that your company needs. And, you know, these are open source achievements that you can build on. Bitcoin is people. So one other thing I really wanted to highlight was travel support. A lot of open source developers are lonely. They suffer from burnout. They're isolated. You know, they spend all their time on a screen. So, you know, if you can have a pool at your company or your organization to just to give small grants out so that open source devs can travel places to go and meet other devs, this is really great. So that's one thing you can do. You can also sponsor, last thing I'll say is you can sponsor open source content at events. So for example, we're a human rights group and we're going to be sponsoring the open source stage at the Bitcoin conference because we think it's the right thing to do. But, you know, you could do that at any mainstream financial event. There could be an open source session or roundtable or something. And it'll do what we're kind of doing on this call is we're drawing people's attention to this thing that they are a little unfamiliar with, but that's very important for the future. You can do that at, like, you can do it through webinars, you can do it at events. So I hope that's just a general idea of how you might want to get your feet wet and join us.
Alex made a lot of great points there. I just want to pull it back real quick and then I'll pull it back forward. First of all, it's easy to think of a lot of this stuff as a tech project, but ultimately it's a movement of individuals. So if you can't stop the systems because it's open source, what happens? The pressure points become the individuals. So how do we support the individuals? And I look at it from three different ways. It's education, which is helping to train new developers, bring new contributors into the space. It's not just developers, by the way. It's designers, product people, all different aspects that are required to make good tools. Then you have like the burnout side that Alex was mentioning, which is supporting the existing developers and contributors, open source contributors, because there's a lot of pressure on their shoulders and it's a relatively thankless job. And that's not just financial support. That's also, you know, moral support and just being there for them. There's a lot of burnout. And then the third thing is what Jack and Mike were mentioning, which is just this idea of liability, right? Legal liability over their code. And them either being hit from a criminal or a civil perspective and supporting them and protecting them in that regard, because these people have families, they're humans, and they are often exposed. Even if they try and operate in a private manner, a lot of people say like, oh, why don't they just pull a Satoshi? That is incredibly difficult. Most people can never pull that off. Satoshi is very unique in that regard, and he should be commended for that. It's absolutely amazing that he's remained private this whole time. That's an exception, not the rule. And now I want to pull it forward again. What Alex was saying, I think, is the dream for a lot of us, is that open source contributors are supported in a distributed and diverse fashion. But it can seem very overwhelming if you're listening to this show. And that's why OpenSats exists, that's why Brink exists, that's why HRF exists, because the whole point is to reduce the friction of being able to support the open source ecosystem. So you don't have to go hire someone. So you don't have to have procedures in place on how you're going to approve grants or what strategies you're going to do. That is, first of all, a very difficult thing to do. It can often be very difficult, time-consuming, financially expensive to your organization. But it also adds additional complexities in terms of biases and conflict of interest that you might not want for your company, or you don't want to expose yourself to it. I mean, in the Bitcoin, throughout Bitcoin history, we've seen many, many cases where developers have essentially gotten bought and paid for by companies that act in malintent. And it's something that everyone should be very aware of. You don't want a single company owning development of a specific open source tool. That itself becomes an attack vector. But with all that said, one organization that has done a really good job of bringing in-house support for open source contributors is Block. Block has a subsidiary organization within Block called Spiral, and that is purely focused on building out open source tools, open source protocols. And I mean, I think it would be really helpful to the audience, Jack, if you just go into a little bit how you think about Spiral and its work in the Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, just to your question, Rod, I don't think we can get I don't think we could or are responsible for getting people excited about open source development. That's a decision they make. What we can do is take excuses off the table and take blockers off the table, to Mike's point. And obviously, there's many ways to do that. Everything we've been talking about, from legal support to funding. And I think that can happen at an individual level. But I think it's really important that companies explore creative solutions around this as well. And that's really what the genesis for Spiral was. I asked Mike Brock, who works at Block, what is the greatest thing we could do for the Bitcoin community? And he said, pay at least 5 developers to work on whatever they want without direction, and let them do it and renew it every single year and make it a part of the company. And we did that. We had the great fortune of hiring Steve Lee, who is really tapped into the community and is super active. And he took that yearly budget. We started with $5 million. And not only did he hire 5 developers where they decided to work on one thing, which was the Lightning Development Kit, but he had access budget that he started giving grants out to developers, to designers, which is a significant need in the Bitcoin space. And then he open sourced the blueprint for it. He open sourced all of our processes and the plans. And our hope was that another company would find this, and we've removed some of the friction and we've removed some of the exploration needed so that you can just copy and paste in many ways. And we're hoping that other companies would just do that and copy and paste and innovate with it as well. But we didn't really see much. I don't know if there's been any, actually, unfortunately. I don't think that'll be a forever state. I do think companies will do this. But if you're, as a company, able to hire an open source developer and give them full free agency to do whatever they want, and to not be accountable to your company metrics, but to be accountable to the thing that they're working on. This is one of the reasons we pay our Spiral folks in Bitcoin, is that they're incentivized to increase the value of Bitcoin by making it stronger, by making it more secure, by making it more accessible every single day. And they'll see the result of their equity, which is Bitcoin, as the work matures and as more and more people use it around the world. So it's a model that has aligned its incentives. Steve also, after all that, like, we've never asked him to do anything, he wanted to give back to Block as well. And he brought up the idea, we should do a non-custodial wallet. We created BitKey. We should do mining. We are about to launch our Bitcoin mining kit and our chips. And we just signed a deal with Core Scientific to supply their entire system. So like, it gives back to the company. He educates all of our employees in the company about open protocols, open source. It's a phenomenal resource. We expect zero return on investment from it, but we've gotten significant return on investment from it. And I imagine there are similar patterns that other companies would see, and not just from a competitive dynamic. I know Tesla has done this and SpaceX has done this in open sourcing a lot more of their work and their network to give that design to their competitors, so that like there's a much stronger foundation that they can continue to get more and more new consumers. But again, like, open source is the fastest way to spread the idea. And if there's not some function in your company that's dedicated to that, I think you're missing out on some significant opportunities to create a lot of value in your company and for all your shareholders.
One thing I would just add, it's not at the Spiral level yet, but I was really happy to see that the founder of BitMEX came out and is going to start their own open source support the other day, led up by Johnny Beer, which is great. So that's an example of someone who's got investment firm and has hired someone who's really deep in the space like Steve, and basically can run a grants program. So again, like, that is one model. You can definitely donate to the folks on this call. I think that'd be a great start. But eventually, yeah, the dream is to really distribute this out and have it normalized for there to be spirals everywhere. We obviously realize that's a decade goal. But the other thing that's interesting, I'm sure Mike can comment as well, is that we're finally getting the pipeline we need. Whereas, like, when we started doing grants at HRF 5 years ago, it was tricky. Like, it was sort of hard to find people to give money to. It was like there wasn't a lot of activity. You know, there were a lot of good developers, but most of them were sort of taken care of or et cetera. Today, it's we've finally turned the corner. I mean, we give a round of grants every quarter, and it is overwhelming the amount of applications we get, and they're really good. And we're finally getting to the point where we can only fund a fraction of the good applications that come in. It's very exciting. So the pipeline is built. It's ready for you all to get involved and either to expand existing groups or to do your own thing. And just to speak to what Jack said about how Spiral has enriched Block, you know, and I know, Kathy, that most people working here are, their day job is probably in a profit company, but a lot of them are on the board of nonprofits. People listening here, a lot of them are. And, you know, you might also be on the board of a school, a university, you might be involved with any sort of nonprofit work. As the head of, you know, heading up this initiative at a nonprofit, getting involved in the Bitcoin stuff, because, you know, for, you know, almost 12, 13 years, we didn't, you know, we didn't really touch it very much. We were founded in 2005, and 2017 is when we started to really get involved very actively. It has been completely transformational for us and has added so much value to us to get involved with Bitcoin. I mean, what we've given to Bitcoin, Bitcoin has given back to us 100x. I mean, I'm not lying. It is so extraordinary. So I would really encourage, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're at a bank or, you know, a fintech company, like even if you're working for, you know, a local community nonprofit or something like that, like getting involved in some small way with this is going to pay massive dividends.
Can I just ask a question in terms of companies like in the financial world and so forth? How have you been trying to get the word out? Because, I mean, we know a lot about Block, but I have not heard, and it'd be we'd be happy to help with this, but I've not really heard this kind of encouragement or advertisement almost for other companies to get involved this way. And, you know, and really highlighting it's more than win-win. You know, there's you get so much more back than you expect, which, you know what I mean? How have you gone about getting the word out?
To that question, like, I don't think we've done a great job. We're hoping for show don't tell approach. And people to follow suit. But we, in the business world, we'd probably be better served, given the makeup of typical corporations, to do some sort of like case study, whether it be an ARK case study or like something like an HBR, like prototypical case study, that we can show the benefit of doing this work and investing in this. I think we were, like, we got pretty lucky with our hire of Steve, and I think it's a pretty unique situation, but I think it is repeatable. I think it's reproducible at different companies, but they have to have a desire to do so. And I think the hardest thing is just to start, because there's not a clear, like, there's not a clear ROI on the investment. And we basically said, we don't care. We think this is right for our work in Bitcoin. We want, I hate this term and the concept, but like some sort of carbon offset to our corporateness. And we need to make sure that we're giving back, given that we're fully aware how much we've taken from open source prior to Bitcoin as well. This is not just about Bitcoin, but like we're fully aware of that. And it just feels like the moral compass of our company should observe that, should recognize it, acknowledge it, and act on it in some small way. And like $5 million a year was not a lot. And we've increased that budget. And it was a good way to experiment. And, you know, I convinced our CFO to take the jump, but it was a small number to start and they performed. And like, we've increased it every single year since forming. But people can start small and do something meaningful. But I do think we could do a much better job in just showing how we did it, why it worked, what we think the future is. So probably in the language of a corporation, it'd be a case study.
To provide a different perspective, Brink is one of the early nonprofits, 501c3s, that wasn't attached to a parent organization and needed to raise funds from the community from the first day. Which put us in an interesting position to need to engage the community. And I've come to the conclusion that, you know, awareness is critically important for the project, but also for contributing as well. Folks need to be aware that this is how it works, that this work needs to be done by someone, and either they're donating their time or someone's donating money to fund them. And so we've done a lot of outreach to Bitcoin exchanges, financial service providers, et cetera. In fact, a month or so ago, we had a meeting with some Bitcoin miners, you know, trying to educate them on what's going on here. And, you know, in the beginning, the miners were the developers, were the holders, but the miners have really become experts in energy and running data centers, and they're not really familiar with the need. And so in presenting to that audience, we tailored a presentation to them, just here's the situation. And a lot of them weren't familiar with it, that there's only, you know, maybe 40 full-time Bitcoin core developers and things like that. So I think awareness and trying to make this thing that's sometimes opaque, this you know, Bitcoin core development as transparent as possible and inform as many people about what's going on is a way to for people to have the opportunity then to decide if they want to contribute in some manner.
Piggybacking off that, I'll make a couple comments, which I think for the folks that maybe you're listening here and say, okay, you know, I'm not technical. I don't work at a big company and they don't have Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So there's no incentive. How can I help? How can I contribute? One thing you could do is go and frequent your local Bitcoin meetup and just be a participant there. Or if you don't have one, starting one. Because I think Gladstein or Mike or Jack or Matt made the point where a lot of these developers are not like lonely, but they want to get out and also talk with other Bitcoiners and just start doing that. And you'll see some magic actually happen from those natural conversations. And Gladstein, I think you've been spearheading this a lot, especially with the HRF work. Community spaces here across the globe have been popping up, you know, in the Bitcoin space. And it's been so fascinating to see. These are non-technical people, not that much. And I mean, who knows what kind of means they have, but they're the ones that are trying to attract and help foster this kind of creative spirit. So I'm just curious to maybe piggyback off of some other ways that we can continue to help this. Maybe go to you, Alex.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I've observed is, you know, companies, BitRefill is a good example. I mean, they're a Bitcoin company, but they fund basically BitDevs and Bitcoin meetups in different cities around the world. And it's a very, very low lift. I mean, light lift. It's a few $100 essentially to pay for some pizza and sodas or whatever for people to hang out. But it's, I mean, the impact is massive. I mean, just speaking as someone who attended the San Francisco BitDevs for a few years, I watched people go through that. Kind of, it's sort of done in a Socratic seminar type thing where there's a teacher and you go through course material and you sit together. There are also just general hangouts, but you can sponsor either. But the point is that, I mean, I watched people go through that and in a matter of 2-3 years, literally change the world. I mean, or create a company that's changing the world. And they were like at the beginning, a just sort of interested coming into Bitcoin. So, you know, sponsoring these meetups is pivotal and very easy to do. And if you're a company in City X or whatever, you could even just post, you could just throw out there, hey, we're willing to sponsor a local Bitcoin meetup. I mean, it's as easy as that. And that the people, you know, here, we're willing to spread that message and that will turn into action. So if you're not comfortable yet with sponsoring technical development or something like that, even just sponsoring Bitcoin communities and meetups is very, very, very important.
We got like 10 minutes to, and we'll wrap. But one other point, and I think Jack mentioned this on the policy side, that's also another kind of attack vector I'm very cautious about. And opening it up to this group, we have the privilege to talk with a number of policymakers. Especially me and Matt having Bitcoin Park. This is a new world for me and Matt, or at least for me, Matt, as I think as well, talking with a lot of the, I mean, dude, it's crazy. We have a congressman that's going to come by today at 3:00. We got senators that roll through here. It is absolutely wild. And there's probably a lot of them that are listening to this podcast. So I'm just curious, like, we got our kind of talk around freedom tech adoption and why this is important, why specifically to Nashville, why we want to make not Silicon Valley, but Sovereign Valley here. But I'm curious for those folks, thank you, Gladstein. Maybe there's lawyers that are listening to this. Like, you know, at Gladstein, you mentioned P2P Rights Foundation. Shout out to Zach Shapiro. He's doing this, you know, he's got his own law firm, but he's doing this, the P2P Rights Foundation. Like, how do we have that conversation with these folks? And by the way, before I open it up to group to answer, here's my hack. Do you know what my hack is? Matt knows my hack. I take them on the tour of Bitcoin Park and so on. And then I kind of give like show them how to use Bitcoin and buy like a little drink and then use Bitcoin with them. And then I'm like, yeah, you're using permissionless money. How cool is that? And they're like, wait, what? What's going on here? And it's just good. Getting people engaged and using this, especially going back to the meetups, are great. But again, going back to the policy folks, I'm curious, maybe to you, Matt, and with BPI's work and others, like how should we engage these folks?
I mean, I think it's kind of a double answer, right? Because it's a similar answer to Kathy's earlier question, which is, you know, how do you get companies engaged? How do you get policymakers engaged? And it's two pieces, right? It's first of all, I think it's great to have them interact directly with the contributors that are working in the space and in the wider open source ecosystem, because they're real people, right? They're real people with emotions, personalities, passions, and they can physically see it and be a part of it. And that's incredibly important. So if you do have a local meetup, like invite people to the local meetup. If you don't have a local meetup, but you want to see your company more involved, try and get leadership to go to the local meetup, right? There's Bitcoin meetups and all around the world. And it's kind of cool because Bitcoin is almost recharging and refueling the global open source ecosystem. So just because it's a Bitcoin meetup doesn't mean it's just Bitcoin developers there. It's people that are passionate about open source software and the open source ethos. And then I think the second piece is, you know, humans are greedy by design. I think one of the beauties of Bitcoin is it doesn't rely on altruism. Like if Bitcoin relied on altruism, it would probably fail. Bitcoin relies on this assumption that all actors will act in self-interest. And as long as they act in self-interest, which is the expectation, then Bitcoin will be robust. And I think it's important to meet people where they're at and explain the benefits. I think for companies, I think their products will be more competitive and will have a larger addressable market if they build and support open systems. And if their customers can use them without trusting the actual company. I mean, we saw with CrowdStrike earlier today how that can affect your company and your business and your bottom line. And then I think on the policymaker side, like I think it's a national security issue. I think America in general, I mean, we're all Americans here. I think America in general is more vulnerable if we don't have a diverse and robust open source ecosystem. If we rely on closed source software, the country is at a greater risk. So how do we insulate our country? How do we make our country more robust in a global digital world that's relying more and more on digital systems? Well, we support and incubate open source robust software and tools that individuals, companies, entities, everyone can use. So as a country, as a whole, we're more protected.
Well said, Matt. Now I have actually an idea while I was just pondering, Jack. I think getting the list of all companies that is public or private, and I think NVK, Matt Odell, has a list, and just hitting up those CEOs and saying, hey, I can help you if you want to do this, like a spiral copy and paste. I do think there's like a little bit of a nudge, and coming from a guy like you, I think could go a long way.
I agree. I'll do that. Just on the policy stuff, we've had a win in the legal space, and it's going to take some time to for adversaries to build up different attacks. But you know, I know they're coming. But the regulatory and policy stuff is real. And to Matt's point, like I think the way we have these conversations with policymakers and regulators is to point out the real threats versus the perceived and fake threats and try to disarm the conversation as much as possible. And just, you know, play a little bit of game theory. Like you look at the US dollar versus the yuan and everything that BRICS is doing, why would you not want to build or help support an open alternative to have a third horse in the race versus having A versus B? Like it's just simple math in terms of optionality and the flexibility you get as a government, as a country, defending your citizens. And I do agree with Matt that it is a national security risk. We haven't had any mention of AI, but a lot of like we've talked about money, we've talked a little bit about speech with Nostr, we haven't talked about intelligence. And intelligence is probably one of the largest horizons within that. And there is a growing open source approach towards AI, but it's very small right now, and it's way behind. And I imagine it'll catch up, but it's entirely dependent and blocked on resources and actually lack of resources. So that's number one. The number two is like, there is suddenly a lot of conversation about Bitcoin from politicians and diplomats, and there is more interest. And I worry a little bit about becoming too excited about that, and so excited that we build a dependency on it. Because Bitcoin does not need that dependency. Bitcoin's whole thesis is removing single points of failure. And if we end up becoming dependent upon a president or a governor or a senator or a Congress or a body of government generally to, again, give us permission, we lost. It's over. And if it feels like we're kind of racing towards that right now with all the noise in the conversation. And I don't know if we're aware of the counterfactuals there and just like the potential attacks using that. And I imagine we'll see some significant positives, and we'll see a lot of broken promises, and we'll see a lot of bait and switches. And if we end in a world where like everyone's disappointed and just give up on the thing because like my chosen person didn't deliver, like Bitcoin loses. So we need to continue to find the people who are here for the principles and here for the origin and here for what was written in that original Genesis block and the problem identified and the solution delivered. If we forget that, you know, we've lost, and I think society has lost globally.
Well said, Jack. And I'll get you the email. I'll be your EA for reaching out to those companies. So I'll get you the emails and everything, by the way. One thing you kind of alluded to was like regulatory clarity. I kind of get like skittish when I even hear that. It's like, I think you were alluding to this. It's like, do we need clarity? We just need to use our money the way we want to use it. And then guys remove a lot of these regulations or hurdles or moats, if you will. I mean, I won't speak on a global level, but that's a lot of the conversations that myself and others are having with these policymakers is saying, I don't need more clarity. I need you to remove all of these obstacles from just using my Bitcoin. And let's go and let the free market decide on X, Y, or Z, or the, you know, whatever three-letter agency just do the work to go and get the criminals and so on. We don't need, regulation is not going to stop or prevent that.
It's just interesting that, like, again, we're doing all this work to build technology that is permissionless. And here we are right now in a posture wondering about the permissions that we need to get.
That's like, very fair.
This conversation is exactly that playing out. And that, like, I don't think we're thinking about that enough and like routes around that. And I think it's a huge distraction that has significant consequence.
One thing I'll just say is that I totally agree. One thing we can do is we can learn from our friends in other countries where, you know, they don't have the same kind of protections or even ability to ask for permission. And Nigeria is very interesting. It's a country that's going to be larger than the United States of America in some of our lifetimes in population. It's the largest country in Africa. And the government's been really merciless towards people using Bitcoin and open source software for money and communications. And yet there's like Bitcoin education there. There's Bitcoin development there. There's Bitcoin schools there. So it just shows that this thing can survive even in very difficult environments. Look, obviously it would be helpful if the government wasn't, coming after us. But even if it is, this thing can still work. So I would just say, that's your white pill here. Like it still works. Even worst case scenario, it still provides hope for people. Even if the government is super adversarial, it still works, which is really cool and nice to know.
So we got like about 5 minutes left, and I'm jacked up as I always am after these Bitcoin brainstorms. And I want to run through a wall right now. For the folks that are listening and so on, and that are like, okay, you know what, to Gladstein, I am on a board. How do I get more involved? Or Jack, I am working at the CEO of this publicly traded company. We do have some Bitcoin on our balance sheet. Yeah, I do want to, maybe set up something like Spiral. Or I'm a developer listening to this right now that I'm working at Netflix, but I'm like bored to death in my life. I want to contribute to and work on base layer Bitcoin protocol. Or I'm listening and I want to be a VC podcaster or the board director and founder of another nonprofit like Matt. Where can they, where are the best places for you guys to point them to and kind of expand maybe a bit on each of your guys' work you're doing on and best location for them to find you? Maybe Gladstein first at HRF.
Well, let's hear from Mike first because I just went.
Yeah, so Brink is a 501c3. We fund Bitcoin Core development. And if you're a developer or interested in helping with development in some ways, even non-technical, you're free to check out what we're up to at brink.dev. We're focused on development, but I would encourage maybe for a broader message that if you're in legal, if you're in communications or marketing or design, that a lot of us are familiar enough with the space to be able to find a good home for you. And a lot of us, well, all of us, had normal jobs before we started doing this crazy stuff as well. And it just took one outreach for me, for example. I reached out to Steve Lee in 2018 because he was doing something non-technical. And I said, well, that's kind of like what I want to do. And now I'm executive director at Brink. So regardless of where you're coming from, it just takes one outreach. So feel free to find us at brink.dev and I can try to help you.
Well said. Matt, how about yourself?
I mean, look, I think that was an incredibly loaded question with 5 minutes left in the show. My contact information is at odell.xyz. Don't hesitate to reach out. Happy to give feedback or guidance to your personal situation. I would say, look, if you're a person, I think the demographic of ARK's audience is quite well off. I think most of you are paying a lot in taxes at the end of the year. So if you want to get a tax deduction, a very low friction way to support the ecosystem is to donate. And you could donate dollars or Bitcoin. I really like the model that some organizations in the space have adopted, which is this idea of splitting donations between our three orgs, right? So my org is OpenSats. You can find out information at opensats.org. Mike's organization is Brink. You can find information at brink.dev, I believe. And then Alex's organization is HRF. You can find information at hrf.org. But the idea of splitting a donation three ways, you split it three ways. That way you don't have to have as much trust in any of our individual organizations to use that money effectively. You get a nice tax deduction. We're happy to work with you if you're a company and you want to do it in a bigger way and do some kind of reoccurring commitment. We're happy to work with you on press releases and comms in that regard and help guide you into the ecosystem. I think one of the issues that I have seen personally being more active in this space and in funding and supporting open source contributors is that not only the open source contributors burnt out, a lot of us that are working in this, in supporting them are feeling the burnout in a real way. And one of the issues we have is it's just the constant fundraising. In terms of support, we're supporting more open source contributors than we ever have in the past. I think just like as far as humanity goes, but it's still barely scratching the surface. I think OpenSats right now, we're almost at 200 open source contributors we're supporting. And we've turned down 800 in the last year just because of a resource management situation. So more support is necessary. And one of the mental time sinks is just constantly having to get on calls with people and getting more donors. So reoccurring donations specifically, tying those reoccurring donations to some kind of KPI, whether that's revenue or profit or something like that, really does go a long way. And it provides some sense of what is the future cash flow for a nonprofit and how you can kind of structure Alex said earlier these ideas of long-term support, how you can kind of structure longer term durations for grants. So not only do we not have to constantly think about where is that next check coming from or where is that next Bitcoin transaction coming from, the grant recipients themselves also won't have to have that burden on their plate.
Yeah, just very quickly, if you're interested in learning more generally about the connection between Bitcoin and human empowerment, we have a lot of content up at href.org/financial-freedom. And it's like a homepage for our whole financial freedom program where we do all kinds of different things, not just support open source developers. That's one part of it. If you want to learn more about that part of it, you can go to href.org/devfund and learn about our Bitcoin development fund. And yeah, I mean, I just think this is happening. I mean, you know, you might be watching this conversation and being like, you know, this seems like a little bit of a stretch. What are they talking about? This is going to be totally normalized across the world over the coming decade. I mean, you're already seeing it. I mean, you know, commentary aside, former president of the United States is about to give a speech about Bitcoin in like a couple of days. Like, this is becoming a thing. This is happening. This isn't not happening. You know, if it was not happening, you know, there wouldn't be that much chatter about Bitcoin and national figures wouldn't be talking about it and nation states wouldn't be mining it, but they are. And there's like all kinds of governments now involved at different levels. So you're doing yourself a big service if you finally say, all right, fine, I'm going to pay attention and just dive in. There's so much good content these days. I mean, Matt's podcast alone is fabulous. He does a weekly recap. That's great. There's just so much good educational content. 10 years ago, it was very hard to sort of grasp because the technology and the communities were very new and edgy, and it was hard to figure out what was going to happen. But it's all happened, and it's very obvious what's happening if you look at it carefully. And you can play a big role in a very important time in human existence. Right now is very important. A lot of people are struggling. Monetary systems are collapsing all around the world, all the time. We have a newsletter that we put out every week, and it's crazy. We're looking at content. We try to just do 5 pieces each week, and it's like, forget human rights violations or poverty generally, specifically about the monetary systems of countries. I mean, there are collapses every week in all corners of the world. So we're relatively insulated from that. We even have our own problems, of course, as Kathy was pointing out, in America and Europe. But like, man, it's rough out there. So building a new system that can be collaborative and open and that can be bridged to different communities as opposed to walled off, so, so important. So please get involved. I think it'd be very great to have more allies here.
Well said. Kathy, before I pass it to you, Jack, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just reach out to my new personal assistant, Rod, and we can hook you up. But,
we're going to go to town. Matt knows my work ethic and how hardcore I am. So we're going to go to town on this.
No, but I would just say to like other CEOs, like I would encourage you or have some intern to like audit the amount of open source software that you're using in your company and be honest about it and see how that feels. Do you feel right just taking from it? And if you don't and you feel bothered by it, then do something about it. And you can start super small, 250K, 500, a million. I think the issue that most people have is they try to do too much at once. But we've talked about a bunch of venues, whether you go straight to these organizations on the calls, you fund a developer in your company, you fund a group of developers in your company to give back. And it doesn't have to be to Bitcoin open source. It can be to any open protocol or any open source that you use, or direct your company just to make sure that there's some percentage of their work that is dedicated to open source. And it doesn't have to be just engineers. Lawyers love working on projects like these. When we started COPA, like we had so many of our lawyers just excited to help out, and lawyers from other companies excited to help out on their off time, not getting permission from their boss or from their CEO, but just like doing it because they believe in it, or they want to learn something new, or they wanted to flex a new muscle and learn a new skill. So the intent is out there. It just needs to be realized. And I would start with just observing how you're using this stuff and how you feel about it.
Thanks, Jack. Kathy.
Sure. We're giving back in a few ways. The very first one, we've been writing about Bitcoin since 2014, since the firm was founded. And so education, I think on every one of the Bitcoin brainstorms, education has come up. That's the starting point, you know, educating people about this profound movement, which yes, has a lot to do with freedom in general, but in terms of helping people in in our community understand, you know, we focused on the technology that it is, the monetary system, global monetary system, and a new asset class. Those are three big ideas all in one. And I think any executive or investor who's not studying this is going to find that there's a lot of disintermediation and disruption that, you know, that they will probably succumb to if they do not, you know, get on the right side of change. This is a big movement. So our research is first that part of our research, and I've had the privilege of spending, you know, it was kind of a retreat with core developers. And part of our role is to vet communities. And I can tell you, I was profoundly impressed at the knowledge, certainly about technology, monetary systems. I was able to offer a little bit more on the new asset class side, but in terms of monetary system and technology, the passion and determination in this ecosystem is profound, and the intelligence. You know, I think my confidence, even though you know, we had been, this was 2019, even though we had been writing about it for a while, my confidence shot up twice. Once when I met the core developers, and then before that, and many of you have heard this story, Art Laffer, here, you know, editing our first paper, Could Bitcoin Serve the Three Roles of Money? And he's basically saying, I've been waiting for this since we closed the gold window in 1971. And, you know, I've been waiting for Art, how big could this be? Well, this is the reserve currency of the internet. That's a very big idea. So our research, it's up on our site. Know that we've met the developers, or many of them, and have been incredibly impressed. And we're also putting our money where our mouth is. So we, many know that we were part of the spot Bitcoin ETF movement. But you will also know that the fee structure collapsed in that. So our initial thought of a percentage of profits well, let's just put it this way. There is going to be very little profitability there. And that's good. It's okay. That, from our point of view, the fees going down, this is a public good. Increasing access to this public good, to this financial superhighway, is the most important service we could provide. So we've done that. But we also do have private strategies. And in order to be true to what we're telling you, contributing to this ecosystem, these organizations and others, we are going to donate consistently a percent of our revenues, not profits.
Wow.
And so that means we will, this is in perpetuity as long as we're still around, and as these funds and they're not even really profitable yet, but that's why we decided to go the route of a percent of revenues.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Well, thank you for all you do. Incredible work.
First of all, I wanted to thank Kathy and everyone at ARC for supporting open source contributors. It's incredibly important. And I think it's important for the audience to know that their first payment has gone out to our three orgs. So whoa, it's more than just
lip service.
Yes. It's actual substance behind it. And it does go a long way. You guys are leading by example. And I think I can speak for all of us when I say that we truly appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. And I have to give so much credit to the team that puts out this research and you know, is launching these strategies, led by Yassine Elmandra, who normally would be here, couldn't today, unfortunately. But David Puel as well, as many of you know David for some of the on-chain analytics that he has evolved in the Bitcoin ecosystem. So,
totally. Well, I'm jacked up. This was amazing. I got a new job. I'm ready to go. And I just want to say, again, thank you to everybody for joining us and listening in. And we will see you next month. Thank you, everybody.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.